My name's Jess. I'm just here to kind of facilitate. It's Michael Lazarus that's going to be doing the main talk. He's currently working his thesis on the social thought of Karl Marx. He describes himself as a Marx scholar, but I felt like I would be embarrassed.
You're supposed to say that. It's a secret.
So I'm just going to say what's absolutely unquestionably true. I would not say he's an authority of us. No, he's all right. He's good. It's going to be a good talk. There's also... as common with all of these sessions, just whatever questions and comments and disagreements, all that stuff, is more than welcome, but just save it till the end after Michael's done his main intro. And it comes with a handout. Has anyone got a handout from another session today? No. So it's a standout already.
Best already.
All right, well, on that note.
All right. So 50 years ago, a huge conference, Marx and contemporary scientific thought, was held in Paris. Eric Hobsbawm, titan of Marxist historiography, recalls attending. And by sheer chance... The conference, held to commemorate 150 years since Marx's birth, would occur at the same time as the revolutionary movement of May 1968. The conference dissolved into protests, and amongst the tear gas, this older generation of Marxists, like Hobsbawm, joined a new generation of young workers and students to whom Marx was the thinker of the moment. This was Marx at 150 years... A long stretch from now, 50 years later, at 200, Marx is yet to be covered with the same passion and heat as 1968. Rather, for the last couple of decades, commentators, social theorists, have often considered themselves post-Marx. The situation is unfortunate. Marx has been pushed to the margins, relegated to the exclusive territory of utopians and fanatics. Since to live in our world means moving past Marx, to fresh insights, contemporary explorations for a contemporary world. However, what I want to suggest today, by way of intellectual biography, is that Marx remains a thinker for the present. It sounds rather predictable. The conference is after all called Marxism. But what I want to depict is Marx the modernist. Marx, who stands not merely as the originator of a worldview, but provides an analysis, which provides analysis of contemporary current affairs, economics, and so on, but Marx is a thinker that remains alive and remains decisive in thinking about understanding the growth, decay and decline of the capitalist mode of production and the fundamental outline of its impact on social being. So Marx as a social thinker. The mainstream political parties, their orthodoxies, economic depression and recession that seem to be permanent features of our lives suggest that there's good reason to keep Marx in the picture and Marx himself in the picture. So, I think maybe to start off, reflecting on Marx at 200 necessitates unshackling him from the mythology. So, one version is that Marx claimed late in his life, as he increasingly attracted disciples and followers, to not be a Marxist. So, the focus of much recent biographical interest, a thinker that can be only understood in the context of 19th century life, workhouses, colonial expansion, and mass working class activity. So these are kind of two most authoritative versions of the Marx myth. You have Marx, the giant thinker, pure, empirical, not tainted by political action, the great analyst, but not corrupted by the taint of any isms. And then you have Marx, the dreamer, the historical figure, long eclipsed by a modern world and a post-USSR paradigm. So the end of ideology is now, and history might well have gone with it. So but I think there's a third element, and it's kind of followers have added to the mythology as well. So you've got vain attempts to kind of save Marx by way of ossification. Marx becomes a scientist. And Marxism is a science, not because it comprehends reality and thought, but because it's believed to be true. You take a series of quotations, you repeat them, and then you have a dead Marx. So I think some of these versions... The myth, this is good, the Marxists, I think of the past, and some of the followers think, will haven't even noticed. This is the situation. So to his friends as well as his foes, Marx can become a dead weight. But when the cliches are brushed aside, we might ask how we'd understand Marx 200 years after his death, 170 years after Capital, I mean 170 years since the Communist Manifesto and 151 since Capital. So I'm going to have a look here in Marx's kind of horrific tomb. It was opened in 1956 by Khrushchev as the kind of the smoke still kind of hovers over Budapest. Soviet tanks sent in to crush the workers' uprising in Hungary. We see in this monument the kind of the monument of kind of the myths of Marx. He's monolithic. He's he's obscene. He's vulgar. He's defied. And I think for this reason, I follow Marshall Berman's suggestion that to understand Marx in our world, we need to lower him to our own level. So, for a sense of how, I want to kind of say a little bit about Marx's life, biographical detail that gives a sense of the man behind this bust, but at the same time, you know, I'll say a bit about the kind of formation of his intellectual thought. So, due to time, I'm not going to be able to say very much about his activism or and specifically the most important part of that within his life, which Luca brilliantly covered in a talk earlier today. And I'm not going to be able to say very much about his critique of political economy. But luckily, if you want to hear that next door, Sagar will be talking about the commodity, which has all of that. So instead, I'm going to talk kind of approach Benjamin's use Benjamin's method of constructing a conceptual image by a collage of fragments. So I'm going to present Marx's life by the way of three letters, which is kind of the handout that I've given you. So I think this kind of helps give sense of Marx's life and the fabric of Marx's life by the polemics, the personal updates, and the theoretical reflections found in these letters. Each letter that you have there represents a turning point. Hundreds of letters survive from Marx's vast, expansive correspondence to his early intellectual influences, to Proudhon and Feuerbach, to shaky publishers that didn't pay up, one to Abraham Lincoln, funnily enough, very many to socialists worldwide, but most to Marx's great friend and collaborator, Frederick Engels. So the first letter we have is to Marx's father in Trier. So in late 1837, Marx is studying law at Berlin University after a short spell at Bonn. At Bonn, he's drinking and he's dueling. The fencing arts, as he describes it here, had concerned his father. And now, after transfer to Berlin, Marx is at pains to demonstrate he's embraced a new lifestyle. Marx's letter to his father, Heinrich, is fascinating. He's 19 when he writes it. He's a man of his class and his environment. His birthplace, Trier, right on the Prussian border with France, had enjoyed progressively more liberal laws. And Heinrich is a kind of successful lawyer. And as his granddaughter, Eleanor, described it, he was a man of the Enlightenment, a real Frenchman of the 18th century. He knew his Voltaire and Rousseau by heart. And he was also politically minded. He was in a kind of pro-French kind of thing called the Casino Club. They sang revolutionary songs and cheered Napoleon and various other things. So this kind of newfound liberal descent came from the turning of an age. The glorious dawn of the French Revolution ushered in a new epoch that decaying absolutist states could only hold back for so long. And Goethe, I think, accurately captures the emergent pulse of this decisively modern dynamic. And he writes, Faust, I feel a lift growing and a warming in me like new wine. I feel the nerve to broach the world now and bear it all, earth joys, earth sorrow, and be a swaggering fighter in the tempest and in the splintering wreck stand fast. Back to Jenny here. So one of Marx's, Marx's father's colleagues, Ludwig von Westphalen, introduced Marx to Goethe, his poetry, and the passions of the intellectual world, poets and thinkers alike, including French socialist thought, Saint-Simon particular, Marx also falls rapidly in love with his daughter, Jenny, and the two enter a secret engagement. Marx is the lower class, Jenny, and aim to kind of hide the controversies that would kind of emerge. Jenny was Marx's lifelong companion, but not a passive bystander by any means. She shared Marx's politics, would attend political meetings, and act as a research assistant, such. One of the few that could make out Marx's handwriting. See here, far from clear. And so kind of Marx this time wrote a large amount of extremely low-quality poetry to Jenny, some volumes of it in kind of fashionable Greco style. But what this letter documents is his kind of his move away from this, and his kind of ambition of becoming a poet is kind of falls away when he kind of engages with philosophy. And so he describes this in the letter. If you look at the first quotation, from the idealism which, by the way, I had compared and nourished with the idealism of Kant and Fichte, I arrived at a point of seeking the idea in reality itself. If previously the gods had dwelt above the earth, now they became its centre. I had read fragments of Hegel's philosophy, the grotesque, craggly melody which did not appeal to me. My aim was no longer to practice the tricks of swordsmanship, but to bring genuine pearls into the light of day. So Marx is in love and in a sick bed, and he describes this kind of intellectual movement. Hegel had died in 1831, and his followers, both left and right, started to contest what was living and dead in the old man's thought. And Marx kind of reflects this engagement as well. He writes in the second quotation there, "While I was ill, I got to know Hegel from beginning to end, together with most of his disciples. Through a number of meetings with friends in Strasbourg, I came across a doctor's club, which includes some university lecturers. In controversy here, many conflicting views were expressed, and I became ever more firmly bound to the modern world philosophy which I had thought to escape." So this kind of letter reveals a certain negligence towards his father, especially as you kind of read on. He kind of seldom writes to them. He seems kind of interested in what's happening at home. Marx's father writes quite constantly to him, and Marx doesn't reply very often at all. And we kind of see amongst this, though, a kind of Marx in transition. He's kind of aiming towards a career in the university, but more and more, this starts to be blocked. He writes a PhD thesis on Greek philosophy, but this path, yeah, again, is closed. The left Hegelians that he's kind of involved and related in the Doctors' Club kind of to discussion, debate, start to lose their jobs. So kind of this kind of means Marx turns much more fully towards politics. And his closest kind of intellectual, companions here are the left Hegelians, especially Bruno Burrow, who's involved in the Doctors' Club here. So the kind of archaic Prussian state, absolutist and interminal decline, which held on to kind of relatively strict censorship laws, backwards laws about parliaments and legislation more broadly, kind of creates a situation where, how do you understand what philosophy's relationship to the world. So the left Hegelians aim to save what they saw as the rational element to Hegel, so his dialectical method, his philosophical approach, and distance the association with the German state, held on to the right Hegelians, who wanted to justify the existing Prussian state by way of by kind of the authority of Hegel, turn him into a state philosopher, so to speak. Marx, however, develops a distinctive reading of Hegel, influenced but distinct from Feuerbach, who's kind of depicted there. This relates to the kind of it relates to a particular method that Feuerbach and a critique Feuerbach has by seeing Hegel as imparting undue rationality on the operation of the state. So Feuerbach says, well, Hegel puts the state first. He doesn't put the citizen body or civil society. He kind of inverts our relationship. And Marx kind of Marx takes up some of that, but he's also complicated at the same time, or his theorization is complicated by the same time with the controversies of the other left Hegelians. So this kind of relates to this kind of situation of how to kind of square the political condition of the Prussian state with the kind of political thought. So Marx increasingly becomes very hostile with the left Hegelians, and he sees them as kind of only settling on religious critique. He says that criticism needs practical application, and it must become worldly, to use his phrase. So for Marx, Germany lacked the social revolution of the French. And in thinking through the struggle for political freedom, Marx becomes increasingly concerned with the potential for human emancipation. So he writes in 1843, let's grab the quote there. So what is the positive possibility of German emancipation? This is our answer. In the formation of a class with radical chains, a class of civil society, which is not a class of civil society, a class which is the dissolution of all classes, a sphere which has a universal character because of its universal suffering, and which lays claim to no particular right because the wrong it suffers is not a particular wrong, but wrong in general. Sphere of society that can no longer lay claim to a historical title, but merely a human one. Dissolution of society as a particular class is the proletariat. When the proletariat claims the dissolution of the existing world order, it is only declaring the secret of its own existence, for it is the actual dissolution of that order. So what Marx does here, especially significantly, is that he identifies the working class as a potential liberator. A universal class that can overcome the fragmentations of modern life. This passage, for the first time, Marx takes the standpoint of the proletariat and of the working class movement. These early texts, what Marx is trying to figure out, is a hostility to the modern state, but this provides the first definite statement for the need for political change well beyond state reform. Marx had written various articles about politics, the riots and censorship, but the 1843 writings especially are pivotal for the development of this theoretical standpoint. These documents show Marx's conversion from a type of radical democratic position to a communist one. Marx isn't the first to think about the division of labour, and he's not the first to talk about class. He doesn't discover the working class as if they're not present in history. That's very much the case in 1789 onwards in political thought. Most social theorists, so onwards, have a very clear sense of these kind of fragmentations. But what Marx does is ground his view in the way that class is a relation between people and society and mediated by labour. This is the kind of significance of what happens here in 1843 and 1844. So kind of Hegel had seen in the philosophy of right, where the division of labour is the cause of alienation and human productive activity, quote, philosophy of right is turned into someone else's property. So this kind of conception of kind of fragmentation through property is present in Hegel, and Marx takes it up. And he takes up its modern property relations, and the modern society is defined by private property relations, which creates the contradictions between different social groups in society and creates an ongoing separation from the worker and the products of their labour. So it's this division of labour that's a key concern for Hegel, as it is for Rousseau, and that a decisively modern condition provides a starting point for further investigation. What Marx does, by looking at the working class looking from the standpoint of the working class, allows a philosophical move that can kind of push past other, Enlightenment thought more broadly. His most important work of this period, speak a little bit more about that, is an elongated attempt to understand the process of human estrangement from the products of human labouring activity. In a series of early notebooks, it's known as the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844, written while he was on honeymoon with Jenny, Marx outlines in fundamental form his concept of labour. For Marx, human beings are productive beings, what he calls Gutterswesen, in essence social, defined by the interaction of human labour in collective and historical settings. The 1844 writings are Marx's first real attempt to understand and critique the most advanced bourgeois thought of his time. And by this, he means classical political economy, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, James Mill, to some extent. And this becomes really Marx's project for the rest of his life and culminates in Capital. So he writes in 1844, political economy only knows the worker as a beast of burden. But to Marx, the worker is much more. Human labour, for Marx, is not simply work. It's defining to our essence as beings. We are beings because of our ability to labour consciously and collectively. Capitalism, for the first time was the historical form that develops this ability to work collectively, to labour collectively, but at the same time fragments and alienates. So I suppose alienation in the process is in which the worker forced to sell their labour through a process of production based on private property is separated from the products of our own labour, and the ability to make decisions about what we make is again removed from our fellow workers and from society at large. And so for Marx, this creates a situation where human labour is held over the worker and distorted. So something that could be a creative act is actually becomes reductive, becomes something that's pressed onto the worker and bears the marks of domination. I think this insight's worth spending some time on for the reason that it grounds all of Marx's work. His 1844 writings are brilliant. They fuse a kind of a lyrical wit and insight with the dire realities of industrialization. Details of these kind of processes had been observed somewhat by Engels in his Condition of the Working Class in England, and in a short essay on political economy, which very much influenced Marx and kind of convinced Marx in some ways that there was insights to be taken from political economy. It was worth reading and critiquing political economy. But so kind of Engels visits Marx for 10 days during the early part of 1844, and this is kind of the start of how they kind of their kind of intellectual collaboration. They write a co-written work, The Holy Family, or Critique of Critical Criticism, although Engels left and Marx continued to write it, so about 90% of the book is Marx's, actually. But it's an exhaustive attack on his left Hegelian foes, who are actually more interested, in Marx's view, in empty moralising, critique of religion, rather than any kind of coherent political activity or strategies to confront the state. Increasingly agitated by the left Hegelians, really. And his kind of polemics, I suppose, his polemics with his competitors is a very common theme in his life. Style of critique often places his own theoretical perspective against an opponent. When he had a lesser mind to pick apart, especially, the reader is taken on and treated to the kind of the force of his literary power. There's a kind of category of people that are kind of forgotten to history but for their place in Marx's critique against them. So more widely read, however, than The Holy Family is a jointly written, although again, mostly by Marx, German Ideology, a kind of critique of various left Hegelians. This is kind of widely misunderstood as Marx's decisive kind of argument against idealism for materialism, and the first true work of Marxism. But I think the German Ideology is kind of better seen as a kind of the start of an elaboration of the kind of the specific role of production in the creation of what he calls a mode of production, which becomes increasingly important for his historical analysis, especially in the next work on the poverty of philosophy. But at this time, also importantly, Marx becomes involved in the workers' movement in Paris and attends meetings and incorporates into his own thinking the radical traditions present in French working-class culture, which at this point is the richest and the deepest in Europe, and this again goes back to 1789. Okay, so have a look. Oh, here's briefly a. This is one of the opening page for the German Ideology. You have Marx has in the section decided that he's going to get rid of it and crosses it out. So if you read the German Ideology today, there's like it's marked what sections that he had decided to get rid of and drawn a line and stuff across them. And then if you can't see at the back, on the right hand side, there's a series of faces that Marx has written on the manuscript that are kind of eating away at the text. And the bottom, which has been fragmented again, if you read it, it breaks off. And so the translators had to try to work out what Marx had said. It's kind of nice. Okay, so the next letter I want to talk about is to the editor of Le Reform. Marx found himself yet again deported for his radical agitation, first from Paris, 45, but now from Brussels. His letter is a public complaint against the arrest of himself and Jenny and their unceremonious expulsion in early March 1848. The letter is dramatic, and alongside complaints about the kind of arbitrary authority suffered on himself and Jenny, there's a sense of the aura that surrounds a city revolution. So you kind of have here the expulsion order from the King of Brussels and the kind of Marx. He called himself Charles Marx, the Prussians. Kind of, quite funny. So Brussels attracted many radical exiles and was now in the process of expelling them. So the vice president of the Brussels Democratic Association, Marx, was a kind of a particularly obvious candidate. He joined the Communist League just a few months before this letter. We have another. Yeah, so this is the travel documents which he issued to Marx after his expulsion. Particularly funny is the description. We've got his complexion is tanned, which... after Brussels, Marx moves to Cologne, where he establishes and edits the new Reichstag Zeitung. This is a period of intense and voluminous journalism, essentially linked to the League. So the kind of the paper is seen as the organ of the League. For these efforts, Marx is put on trial in Cologne, and his defence speech is a tour de force of political analysis. He damns the weak German bourgeoisie, who were unable and unwilling to lead their own revolution. Final issue of the paper was printed entirely in red, you can kind of see it here, and includes a kind of clarion call towards the end of the end of the kind of editorial, as you see here. So at this point, Marx is kind of stateless and a refugee, which is very common for a series of other kind of German and French socialists, but kind of the only place for refuge is London. So Marx is able to move there in 1849. But as the revolution spread throughout Europe in 1848, Marx had kind of engrossed himself in the practice of revolution. The sublime product of this historical movement is the Communist Manifesto. It's obviously Marx's most famous, well-quoted and well-remembered text. However, it came from a collaborative effort and it's commissioned and approved by the Communist League. 23-page document remains in every sense a grand politics, a grand vision of politics. Marx declares history, the history of the world, as one of class and class struggle. But again, he's a modernist here. It's modern society that creates the greatest wonders and the greatest turmoil of human experience. Bourgeois age clears away the archaic garb of feudalism and the religious and political veils of hierarchy and provides equality, but this equality is equality of naked self-interest. In a remarkable passage, he writes, "Constant revolutionizing production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguishes the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air, and all that is holy is profane. And man, at last, compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind." So what Marx is doing here really is describing a two-sided development in the formation of bourgeois society. Society that constantly reinvents itself, creates extraordinary wonders, but based on gross accumulation, exploitation, and all its trimmings, colonization, poverty, oppression. However, Marx argues that the weapons in which the bourgeoisie felled feudalism to the ground are now turned against the bourgeoisie itself. Capitalism, as Marx famously declares, creates its own gravediggers. So Marx in 1848, as much as in 1844, sees the workers' movement as a movement for power in which the free development of human beings becomes a mutually shared and collective act. To Marx, this is only possible under a classless society brought about by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. All right, so looking at the third letter now, it's a facsimile of it. On the 16th of August, 1867, at 2 a.m., Marx writes to Engels, "Dear Fred, have just finished correcting the last sheet, 49th of the book. The appendix, form of value in small print, takes 1 to 1.25 sheets. Preface ditto returned correctly yesterday. So, this volume is finished. I owe it to you alone that it was possible. Without your self-sacrifice for me, I could not possibly have managed the immense labour demanded by the three volumes. I embrace you full of thanks. Enclosed two sheets of corrected proof, the £15 received with best thanks. Salute my dear valued friend, yours, Karl Marx. I think so much about Marx's relationship with Engels is in these first few lines. First off, we see Marx supported, Engels supported Marx financially. Seems as if no letter from Marx to Engels was complete if it didn't say something about money, if it didn't ask for money, mainly. And I think it's very clear because Marx lived a precarious life. Marx was always on the threshold of poverty. It was a tragic life riddled with deaths and significant hardship. Of all of Marx's children died in tragic circumstances. Two as infants, not 1 year old. His son Edgar at 8. His daughter Jenny of cancer less than 2 months before his own death. And the other two daughters, Eleanor and Laura, both suicide. The Marx has always lived, again, one step away. Frequently too short to pay his debts. Marx pawned his books, his coats, and Jenny's family heirlooms. On one occasion, Marx had to visit the pawnbroker before he could afford the coffin for Edgar's small dead body. Marx noted that no one had ever written so much about money that had so little. His years in London are frequented by moves from house to house, depending on where which income he could get, and when the situation improved by some inheritance or publisher's deal, most often by Engels' generous support, Marx would be able to kind of try to live a life of normality and move to more comfortable houses on one occasion through the girls' ball. Always after bourgeois respectability. It was not just poverty that plagued Marx's life, but also sickness. The last 10 years, especially, were devastated by bronchitis. Marx often battling very large boils. You kind of go to the countryside to kind of get some treatment, which would take up a huge amount of time and was severely hindered by this condition. And so really, the last 10 years, Marx just reworks various sections. The vast bulk of Capital and his major works have been written before the 1870s. He writes significant things during this period, but it's one where he finds it much harder to do the type of work necessary. But turning to the letter, what it also shows is the special relationship in the intellectual project shared by Marx and Engels. Just as he's finished proofing these sheets, his life work, in the very early morning, he must write to Engels. Not a moment could be missed, or you feel not a moment could be missed between the two for such accomplishment. In 1851, Marx had written to Engels that he would be done with the whole economic shit in 5 weeks' time. This is 5 weeks turns into 16 years. So, the letter in front of you includes an update about the kind of key theoretical part of the book, or one of the key theoretical parts, the appendix, which is incorporated into later editions to be the last part of the first chapter of Volume 1, which is now subtitled as The Fetishism of the Commodity and its Secret. This section is of vital importance to Marx's theory of value. So soon after, he comments about kind of what the book attempts to do. He writes to Engels at a particular point. He says, "The best points of my book are, one, the twofold character of labour, according to whether it is expressed in use value or exchange value, which is brought out in the first chapter, and two, the treatment of surplus value." Okay. What he's doing here is the twofold character of labour is the unity, concrete, an abstract labour under a commodity-producing society. Concrete labour, concrete useful labour is transformed by the process of capitalist production into a quantifiable amount that can be exchanged and traded in a market of equal commodity owners. Quality falls aside to sheer quantity, again another inversion, as measured in labour time. So useful labour or use values become supplemented by exchange values. Labour is not a creative function, becomes measured in the time of the day, sold to the capitalist, and provides a basis for surplus value as profit. The quality of human labour used to create products of human need is negated by a system where exchange dominates the entire logic of human relations. Marx sees capitalism as a system of social relations mediated by the products of labour. That's what he's doing here. So this is a development of the insight in 1844, the alienation, products of human labour held over human beings, but here he adds something to it by seeing surplus value coming from the abstract sellable quality of labour. An elaboration on this theme, but worked out at a much more concrete level. So when Marx speaks of the secret of the commodity, he is aiming at mapping the social functions that are hidden by the veil of the capitalist mode of production. He wants to reveal the essential social relations hidden and obscured by the overpowering logic of the commodity. So capital consumes Marx's thought for decades. While he had initially a much kind of wider plan for a separate work on the state, on the dialectic, one on the world market, to kind of construct a system, really, his critique of political economy becomes much more intensive. He attempts to kind of bring all these things into the single work, and he kind of has several attempts at writing Capital. Really, the most important and a largely underappreciated work, the Grundrisse, is a kind of series of notebooks from 1857 to 58, which is effectively the first draft of Capital. And the focus on the concept of value, especially, demands that the finished version of Capital, the 1867 text, is reread with the kind of the philosophical stress of his earlier terminology and emphasis. But really, Capital is the work to judge Marx by. It's vast, it's lyrical, and lucid, but flawed and unfinished. Above all, it's a profound effort to understand the categories and operations of capitalist modernity. Capital's development is historical. It happened. But it's also logical. By this, I mean that Marx adopts Hegel's mode of thinking to suggest that to understand capital, we have to know how it comes to be. How the categories that characterize capitalism, commodity, money, capital, unfold through a series of mediations to its fully formed shape of being, so it becomes purified. To understand this, to understand the world we live in, Capital is a work that demands that any overcoming of the vast oppression that exists in capitalism means negating capital itself. There is no solution outside or external to our world, but through an imminent destruction of the economic categories that stand over us and determine our existence. So, one final letter. It's dated March 15th, 1883, and it's from Engels to Johann Philipp Becher. And he was a participant in the revolutions of 1848 and in the First International. The occasion is Marx's death. He writes to Becker, "My dear old fellow, be thankful that you saw Marx last autumn, for you will never see him again. Yesterday afternoon at 2:45, after leaving him alone for less than 2 minutes, we found him perfectly asleep in his armchair. The greatest mind of our party had ceased to think, the strongest heart that I have ever known has ceased to beat. It was in all probability a case of internal hemorrhage. You and I are now almost the last of the old guard of 1848. Well, we'll remain in the breach. The bullets are whistling, our friends are falling around us, but this is not the first time we too have seen this. And if a bullet hits one of us, let it come. I only ask that it should strike fair and square and not leave us long in agony. Your comrade in arms, Frederick Engels." So Marx dies just about a year later than his wife. They kind of die together in some ways. And Eleanor kind of describes their kind of mutual sickness. "It was a terrible time. Our dear mother lay in the big front room, more in the small room behind, and the two of them, who were so used to each other, so close to one another, could not even be together in the same room." His daughter dies very soon after this as well, after her mother. Kind of Marx, having lost his wife and his firstborn, very much dies a broken man. But I don't really want to finish with Marx's death. But kind of the first picture I showed was Marx's present grave in Highgate Cemetery, one that stands as an ongoing legacy of distortion and of caricature. For this reason, I'm going to conclude with the vision of Marx as the thinker that allows us to understand the world as it is, riddled with forms and modes of being that held over us. If we return to what Marshall Berman describes as Marx's melting vision, where fixed modes of being are blown asunder amid new processes of understanding, we gain for Marx the ongoing importance of the fluid dynamics of modern life. Just as it seems as if capital couldn't be more ossified, Marx reminds us all that is solid melts into air, all that is holy is profane, and man can at last be compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind. For me, Max Ernst, old man loading a package of clouds on his back, depicts this experience. The old man struggles to touch the ground, to become fully formed, as he carries a great burden. The clouds appear to direct him, he appears to turn away from them and to be struggling against their weight. This experience is not unlike the mode we all inhabit, as the commodity's reified logic hangs heavy. Marx's life and thought must be understood as the struggle against this all-encompassing logic. What Marx seeks to understand is the essence of the social relations that guide our lives, determine our labour, distort our beings and control us. Marx is not a thinker of doctrine, fully formed, fixed for all times, but of social realities, fluid and dynamic. Genesis, its nature of being, and its historical movement. Modern life to Marx is alive with possibilities, paths and forms of resistance that gives primacy to the potential of the working class to become revolutionary. Here Marx lives on. As long as the world we live in is the one riddled by the commodity, Marx survives with capital. It's in how we might break the chains that bind us, Marx's legacy and his substance as revolutionary activity still needs this melting image. And I think this is how we should understand Marx at 200.